Our next presenter is Addison Brenner. She is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Health Behavior and Education at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Her research revolves around the effect of neighborhood social and economic factors on adolescent development and behavior, as well as the effect of neighborhoods on psychological stress and allostatic load in African American adolescents and adults. Addison plans to defend her dissertation in the winter and continues her research on the influence of the socio-ecological context on psychological and behavioral outcomes. Prior to attending the University of Michigan for her doctoral work, Addison studied familial wealth and child development at Yale University, where she received her MPH in chronic disease epidemiology.
I didn't realize that was so long. Also, we seem to use the same format of the slides here. So
it wasn't purposeful.
It wasn't. I just realized that. So, welcome. Again, my name is Allison. Thank you for being here. So this is a part of, this is one of my papers in my dissertation, which is kind of a larger part, of course, of my research, which really focuses on stress as a mechanism in which health inequalities are both generated and sustained. And I also kind of, I use this to link structural factors, specifically racism and segregation, to health inequalities and new relationships to disclose. Okay, so unequal distribution of stress by race and as well as socioeconomic status might play a very significant role in population-level health inequalities. And research indicates that where people live matters. So I know I've been to many presentations already that talk about the kind of importance of place and context. Research indicates that, so exposure to stressors, we know, varies based on where you live. There are physical characteristics of the neighborhood, social characteristics, as well as the availability of resources, which all, which all affect your exposure to stressors. And so recently, researchers have recommended that future work in the area of neighborhoods and health really examine these processes and analyze the processes through which social, behavioral, psychological factors all interact to influence health and how they vary across different neighborhoods. And so kind of in light of those recommendations, in this study, I first look at the trajectory of perceived stress in my sample over time. I examine both neighborhood as well as individual level variation in perceived stress. And I also examine cross-level interactions, so interactions between these individual and interpersonal factors and the neighborhood-level factor. So I draw from the foundation of the socio-ecological framework in my research, which guides interactions between levels and really situates the individual in this larger framework. The policy level is actually also a part of this, but I don't focus on it, so I didn't want to include it here. The socio-ecological framework also kind of helps us think about these bi-directional influences on health. So it's not, of course, just the organizations that affect interpersonal factors in individuals, but the individual also kind of then affects the community. So I also use several neighborhood theories to guide my research. So there are kind of neighborhood structural models and social models. Structural models really examine associations between socioeconomic indicators of neighborhoods and health via social pathways, as well as cultural and psychological mediating processes. And this is where you're really going to see your census indicators and socioeconomic disadvantage. And then social models, so this could be either social capital or social disorganization models, these connect structural and economic factors in the neighborhood to health, and often you'll see mental health via social pathways. And so these often include stressors, so things like crime, violence, presence of drugs in the neighborhood. And we know that these stressors are more prevalent in neighborhoods that are more disadvantaged. So as you can see, these models are certainly theoretically related. They're also statistically related, and they're not mutually exclusive, yet much research really kind of examines them separately and kind of relies on one model or the other. So I try to kind of integrate both into my research. And finally, I use the transactional model of stress and coping to connect stressor exposure in the neighborhood to psychological health outcomes. And this model includes, it's a pretty big model, but several things it includes are stressor appraisal, and then based on the stressor appraisal, coping and how individuals choose to use their coping resources to deal with the stressor, and then social support as typically a stress buffer. Okay. So my specific hypotheses, based on the literature and based on theory, I expect that individuals living in neighborhoods with higher levels of socioeconomic disadvantage to report more psychological stress over time. And this is really kind of based on neighborhood models. I expect that higher levels of individual risk, in my case I'm examining substance use, result in more stress, and then conversely, higher levels of protection result in less stress. And so these really kind of come from the socio-ecological framework and stress and coping theories. So this is just an image of my conceptual model, and so you can see that I'm looking at this direct pathway between exposure to neighborhood stressors, and I focus on neighborhood disadvantage and perceived stress, as well as several factors that moderate this pathway. So I'm going to talk about my data. I'm going to go through the data and the methods relatively quickly in the sake of time, and I'm happy to talk more about it later. So I use data from the Flint Adolescent Study, which is a longitudinal study that began in 1994 and recruited adolescents when they were entering high school. Flint, Michigan is an urban, it's a relatively socioeconomically disadvantaged city in Flint, Michigan. The sample was about 80% African American, and in this analysis, I actually restricted to only the African American youth. The sample is also a high-risk sample based on academic risk upon entering high school. So I use 7 of the waves of this study beginning in 1995, and the youth are close to 15 at that point. And my dependent variable is perceived stress using Cohen's perceived stress scale. I include several individual factors, demographic variables, social support, substance use, high effort coping, and 2 neighborhood perception variables. So we asked about attitudes about your neighborhood, as well as are you afraid of violence in the neighborhood. And then my neighborhood level variable was a composite measure from 2000 census data of socioeconomic disadvantage, and it included factors similar to percentage of households living below the federal poverty level in the census block group, percentage of unemployment, and a few similar factors. So I used a growth curve model to test my hypotheses. This is a 3-level model and enabled me to kind of model the trajectory of perceived stress over time throughout that 7 waves that I'm examining. And I included 2 different growth parameters, so parameters that kind of reflect time and change in time, a linear growth parameter as well as a curvilinear parameter. And I controlled for demographic variables at baseline. I also included a random intercept and slope term, and basically just what this just means is that I allowed for some variation, random variation, at the neighborhood level in my outcome, which was perceived stress, so I can look at neighborhood kind of differences. So my model included a little, slightly over 4,600 data points from 655 individuals in 162 census block groups. I found that perceived stress did change over time, and I found kind of a linear decrease. So it started at age 15 at a higher point and decreased linearly until approximately age 20 when it started to kind of flatten out, and then it actually gradually increased a bit during ages 21 and 22. I do want to note that the actual kind of degree of decrease in terms of quantitative values was very small, but it was statistically significant. Okay, so this is just kind of a graph of the effects of neighborhood disadvantage on this stress trajectory, perceived stress trajectory, and I just want to kind of orient you to the graph because I know it's a lot to take in at once. So the y-axis is perceived stress, and then the x-axis, which is labeled as age, is time. And I know it's a bit misleading because it starts at 0. I centered it on age 15, so 0 represents age 15, and then each increase from there is a 1-year increase, so it goes until about age 22. So you can see there's 3 different lines based on the tertile of neighborhood disadvantage. This top line represent individuals living in neighborhoods with the lowest level of disadvantage, and then the bottom line, the solid blue line here, represent individuals in the, I'm sorry, I said that the opposite way. The bottom line is for individuals in the lowest disadvantaged neighborhoods and the top in the highest disadvantaged neighborhoods. And so what you can see from this graph is that individuals in these high disadvantaged neighborhoods are actually experiencing a steeper decrease in stress over time, and individuals in these less disadvantaged neighborhoods have a more gradual decrease in stress, and then actually kind of both of the average as well as the low disadvantaged neighborhoods, an increase in stress around age 20 and 21. And I'm going to talk a bit more about that later in my presentation. So in general, disadvantage was associated with initial stress levels at baseline as well as the change in stress over time. There was no significant variation in perceived stress at baseline based on an individual's neighborhood. So the neighborhood didn't really matter so much at baseline. However, there was variation in perceived stress over time based on the neighborhood. And you can kind of see how, actually, these right here are significant differences. Neighborhoods really do matter in terms of the perceived stress level at certain points in this trajectory. Okay, so after looking at kind of the effects of neighborhood on the perceived stress trajectory, I entered my individual level models, variables into my model, and I found that more substance use and individuals who reported more fear of violence in their neighborhood also reported more stress over time, and individuals who reported more coping, higher levels of social support, and more favorable attitudes toward their neighborhood had less stress over time. So these results are fairly consistent with what we might expect based on the literature. However, once these individual level factors were included in the model, the effect of time actually disappeared. So the kind of change in perceived stress over time wasn't significant. Another interesting thing is once I included these factors in the model, the effect of neighborhoods really disappeared. There was no more variation in perceived stress based on neighborhood. And then finally, I examined some cross-level interactions. So this was interactions between the individual and interpersonal factors and my neighborhood disadvantage variable, and there were no significant cross-level interactions. However, there was some unexplained variation in the relationship between high-effort coping and perceived stress at the neighborhood level. And so, basically, this means that there's something going on in kind of the relationship between a person's coping efforts and their stress trajectory that has to do with their neighborhoods. However, my variable, neighborhood disadvantage, didn't explain it. Okay, so first of all, the results were consistent with theories of adolescent development and stress in general. We know that adolescence is a time of, people have talked about it being a tumultuous time, and so we would expect that stress is a bit higher during adolescence, and so I did find higher levels during middle adolescence that did begin to decrease, so youth might be might be learning to better cope with stressors, they might be building their social support networks as they age. And then I found this kind of increase in stress around a period which we call the transition into adulthood, around 20, 21, 22 years old. And this also seems somewhat consistent with the literature. As youth are transitioning from adolescence into adulthood, they are taking on different social roles, they're maybe getting married and having families and dealing with different types of stressors. Also found support for the stress and coping model in that higher social support and better coping reduced stress. We found partial support for our neighborhood models, where we found that there was this relationship between neighborhood disadvantage and stress. However, this is where kind of I found this somewhat odd relationship or surprising relationship. So just to kind of bring this back up so you can see it as I'm talking about it. So we had this odd relationship where individuals in less disadvantaged neighborhoods actually had a more gradual decrease in stress and then an increase in stress. So I have a couple hypotheses. I'm actually just finishing off this paper, so if anyone has any ideas, I would love to hear your theories. One thing I thought about was this idea of kind of an effect of a numbing effect. So in some research on poverty, children living in poverty, Elder and colleagues had found that there were kids living in chronic poverty, kind of became numb to the effects of poverty and reached this point which he termed emotional equilibrium. And so something similar could be happening in our sample where individuals in the highest disadvantaged neighborhoods actually kind of become numb to the effects, reach this equilibrium, and then their reactivity to stressors just is decreased. And so we expect during adolescence into adulthood stress to decrease, and their stress is decreasing as we might expect. However, their peers in the less disadvantaged neighborhoods might not reach this point of emotional equilibrium, and they might kind of constantly be more reactive to stressors. So that's one theory. Another one is related to goal-striving stress. And goal-striving stress is this idea of a mismatch between effort and reward. And so we know that, the idea about goal-striving stress is that individuals, and this typically is discussed in terms of African-American communities where, people in the communities really are facing these larger structural barriers to success. And so, people might put out a lot of effort, but then they're not able to succeed because of these barriers. And this mismatch between effort and outcome really creates a lot of psychological stress. And so it's possible that for individuals living in these highly disadvantaged, probably highly segregated neighborhoods, that they're in this chronic state of disadvantage and they really don't expect to be able to overcome these barriers. They might have lived in these neighborhoods for many years, and so they don't have this mismatch between expectations and reward. Conversely, individuals in the less disadvantaged neighborhoods, you know, might have seen examples and have seen people that were able to kind of overcome the barriers, move out of the neighborhood, succeed, and so they might be constantly trying to kind of, you know, fight against it, which might create more psychological stress. So let me just go back here to the kind of partial support for the neighborhood models. Just to remind you, though, this all, kind of the relationships between neighborhood disadvantage and perceived stress did disappear when I entered individual factors into the model. I also did find the relationship between attitudes, some more positive attitudes resulted in less stress and more fear, resulted in more stress. So this supports some of the social neighborhood kind of models and ideas of interactions in the neighborhood. And then finally, I found partial support for the socio-ecological framework. While I didn't find any significant cross-level interactions, I still did find that this kind of multiple levels of influence on adolescent and young adults' perceived stress trajectory. Okay, so now kind of what does this all mean? Well, there are a few ways that we can look at it. You know, maybe neighborhoods matter, but individual and interpersonal factors matter more. And this is a constant debate in this literature. So this is one explanation. It's also possible that neighborhoods matter, but they matter at different times. So maybe they matter more during childhood, when the effects that neighborhoods exert on individuals, you know, might be stronger. They might have a greater effect on interpersonal networks during this time. I was actually reading an article, there's an article in the American Sociological Review that literally just came out this past month, and I was reading it on the plane as I was coming here, which was quite timely because it was an article that was looking at different methods. They were actually using an inverse probability treatment weighting method to look at kind of, they were looking from childhood into, I think, around 20 or so, I might be wrong with the age, but they were looking at the effect of neighborhood over kind of a really long-term period, and they were looking at changes in disadvantage over time, as well as time-varying confounders. So there's this issue with selection bias in neighborhood research. So they were looking at the way that these time-varying confounders that might affect selection into and out of neighborhoods also affect, they were looking at educational outcomes. But they found that once they use this methodology, as opposed to just looking at more of a current, you know, census like I did, they found much stronger relationships between the effect of neighborhoods on educational outcomes. So this really suggests that it's important to kind of look at the chronicity of, you know, people's kind of movement into and out of neighborhoods. So that also might, you know, be one reason that I didn't find stronger results. Research, of course, needs to include different measures of neighborhood. I use neighborhood disadvantage due to just kind of data issues. However, it's important to look at other social factors, look at segregation, look at crime and violence, social, you know, capital and collective efficacy. One thing, too, that I, you know, think that this research really suggests is that we see this kind of trajectory in perceived stress. It's not a static, it's not a static characteristic of an individual. So future intervention and prevention programs really should make sure that they're kind of targeted towards certain areas in that stress trajectory, and thinking of which, you know, what risk factors and which assets might be most kind of influential at which points to better target intervention. So just to quickly make sure that I certainly note my limitations, I talked a bit about the limitations of neighborhood disadvantage. Also, there still was, I didn't see a lot of variation at the neighborhood level in perceived stress. It was significant, but it's still a very small percentage of the variation. As I said, I did not examine change in disadvantage over time, nor did I account for kind of the time that people spent in a particular neighborhood. I did do some kind of sensitivity analysis and a bit of work with this, which I didn't present. And I found I kind of controlled for change in disadvantage for each individual between each wave in the study to look whether they increased or decreased in disadvantage more than like one standard deviation. Controlling for this did not make a difference, so that kind of adds a little bit more confidence to the results. I also examined differences between 1990 and 2000 census data by block group, and that wasn't a very few proportion of the block groups changed significantly in disadvantage. One other thing that I'm kind of posing this idea of inoculation or numbing effect, where initial exposure to stressors in disadvantaged neighborhoods might increase stress, but then, you know, individuals kind of get adjust to the level of stress. This can actually be tested statistically, and I did not do that. And finally, my strengths. I use longitudinal data. I laugh every time I see that picture. I use longitudinal data, and I covered 7 waves of my study, using which included 2 very important influential developmental periods, which are adolescence and this transition into adulthood. I used a high-risk sample, also an African-American sample, which is important for some of the kind of theory behind what I was looking at in terms of structural inequalities and effects on health. I used multi-level modeling, which allows you to account for variance. I accounted for variance at 3 different levels in my model and was able to test cross-level interactions. And finally, I feel like it's important to kind of base this research on theory in terms of the hypothesis development, the analytic techniques and methods, as well as interpretation of the results. So thank you very much for your attention, and I appreciate being here.
Okay, so now we'll have the question and answer session. So if you wish to ask a question, just raise your hand. Thanks.
Oh, I see what you mean. This gentleman is asking, you know, the church, you know, different kind of church. There are synagogues, could be Buddha, could be all kind of categories. We didn't, in our questionnaire, we didn't separate them. We just asked, you know, the same question. How many times you visit a church in the past year? So people, whatever they think, they just answer the question. We didn't have specific definition for the church.
That's
a question related. Yeah. But I think you have a good question. Basically, different organizations, they have different views for suicide ideation, different life. Certain religions do not support the suicide ideation idea. Do not think that's the coping or the strategy for resolve the problem.